This is the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley, and we are on the audio only this week. Now, there's, as ever, lots to discuss. Today was the publication of the Chilcot Inquiry report, so we'll be talking a little bit about that and the legacy of Iraq on British politics. But we're going to be focusing mainly today on the race to be the next Prime Minister, which, of course, is very important. We'll be looking at some recent YouGov polling that shows Theresa May in a strong position and asking whether or not she's inevitably the next occupant of Number 10. And we'll also be generally talking about the fallout of Brexit and sort of what comes next for the country. But I'm joined today by fellow podcaster from Penshone Berland, Rob Vance. Rob, hello.
Great to be here, Kieran.
So, Rob, we haven't actually had a chance to catch up too much about the Brexit vote. It's only a couple of weeks ago. It's almost difficult to remember that at times. Everyone's asking for solutions, and we're less than a fortnight after it. But, I mean, what was your impressions of some of that before we go on to Iraq and Theresa May?
Well, I think I'm not going to say anything particularly original here, I suspect, but I think it did reveal a pretty big divide bubbling up to the surface that has shaken, if you like, the political class and the elites in a way that they're completely unaccustomed to. I think the clues were there, but the overwhelming turnout amongst Leave supporters, lots of it in, you know, northern post-industrial constituencies that tend to have fairly low turnouts because they have safe incumbent Labour members of Parliament, I think shocked many people. It's one of those classic things when every election people talk about turnout and people always sort of expect themselves to be disappointed. But once again, young people didn't turn out quite, you know, even by my own estimation, sort of surprisingly
turnout
low levels.
Turnout itself was pretty high.
Turnout in itself was, yeah, exactly. But it was where the turnout was high. So, you know, lots of leavers, older groups, people who haven't voted in generations in some cases, clearly must have been going to the polls. And their votes were stacking up in places which were clearly opposed to the EU, or at least, you know, opposed to, or in support of elements of the campaign, of the Leave campaign. So, you know, I think... what's interesting now is that you've got a situation where both the Tory party and the Labour party at a kind of leadership level are racked with divisions that actually bear little relation to the divisions that I think were exposed in the poll 2 weeks ago.
So, I mean, we'll come back to Brexit, I'm sure, in our discussions about the Tories and what comes next. But the big story this week is, of course, the Chilcot inquiry, very long in the making, I think it's fair to say, maybe typical British understatement there. I mean, some of the findings, it's a 2.6 million word report, right? So we haven't got the ins and outs of it. But
I'm only halfway through.
But some of the summary from the BBC here is that UK went to war before peaceful options for disarmament were exhausted. Military action was not the last resort. The invasion in 2003 was based on flawed intelligence and assessments that went unchallenged. The threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were presented with a certainty that was not justified. And Tony Blair says, Tony Blair has said his decision was made in good faith, but he takes full responsibility for any mistakes, whatever that means. Needless to say, the families of Britons killed say the conflict was a fiasco and do not rule out legal action. I mean, the Prime Minister has cut a sort of somber sort of jib, if you like, saying that the sacrifice of the war dead will not be forgotten. Meanwhile, Jeremy Corbyn says war was an act of aggression launched on full pretense. Now, as we're recording this, the debate is ongoing in Parliament, but it does feel pretty damning for Tony Blair and his legacy, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about... I'm always cautious about the word legacy. I think, obviously, the commentariat and so on will always talk about Iraq as Blair's legacy, and rightly so. I think it's important, as a card-carrying Labour member, should probably point out that the Labour government did other things other than Iraq during the 13 years of being in power. But clearly it casts a long shadow, and rightly so, as I think most people would accept, a tragically executed thing and something which was clearly, I think, on reflection, a mistake. I think it's worth pointing out, of course, that whether or not Tony Blair and Britain had been involved in the Iraq war, it would have almost certainly happened anyway. And, you know, the US played obviously a far bigger role in terms of its commitment of both lives and, you know, financially and all the rest of it in it. So I think there's always a slight disconnect for me in terms of the way in which people talk about Iraq as being the personal foible of Tony Blair, when, of course, he wasn't by any means the only person involved in it. That said, I think what's interesting to me is the way in which this obsesses lots of people in politics and the civil service, and clearly there's lessons to be learned from across the place, but also how actually in the public memory it's relatively fallen off their agenda. You know, that fortunately we're no longer engaged in on the ground there. you know, on the doorsteps, people are much more concerned about all sorts of other things. Clearly, it's an example of one of many things in terms of the disconnect between politicians and the public in terms of trust and belief in what they say. And that clearly had some ramifications 2 weeks ago in terms of, you know, the comparison between people believing Cameron's claims that the economy was about to collapse if we voted to leave the European Union and Tony Blair's claims that there were weapons of mass destruction. But I think you can overdo the parallels.
Mm. I mean, the polling on this is interesting, actually. I'm just looking through some YouGov data, which shows, perhaps unsurprisingly, that 51% think the decision to go to war by the US and Britain was wrong versus 26% think that it was right. And to be honest, without delving into the numbers too much, that's pretty much been the picture since Saddam Hussein was killed. I mean, I think before that it was a bit of an up-and-down trend, but actually since then it's been seen as pretty much a disaster. But then there was a poll in 2015 that asked about sending ground troops back to Iraq to fight ISIS, and actually 39% approved, 39% disapproved. So I suppose there's a issue there, an interesting debate there for the future leadership of the country about, does the legacy of Iraq mean don't do anything there again? But I guess that's for another day, I suppose.
Well, I think, but it highlights a really important point though, which is there are people who were always opposed to the Iraq war, like Jeremy Corbyn, who may well have been opposed to the Iraq war for, you know, sincere reasons, but ones that actually other people who weren't opposed at the time didn't agree with then and perhaps, you know, don't actually agree with now. So I think it's one thing to be a pacifist and someone who doesn't believe that any kind of international intervention is appropriate. That's quite different from saying that you can go to war under false pretenses and then resent massively that, you know, that I think the public fall off in trust, you know, evolves from a point where they were told that there were weapons of mass destruction and that it was in contravention of the UN Security Council. And this was, you know, in effect, upholding international law by going in and finding these weapons of mass destruction. That's quite, and, you know,
which then, is not the argument that the American government used.
Sure, absolutely not.
Domestically, there
it was
quite it?
Fundamentally. It was fundamentally part of the argument that Tony Blair made to both Parliament and the country, and Corbyn opposed that.
But
the public erosion of trust comes from, first of all, there not being any weapons of mass destruction. Second, it not being anywhere near as simple as decapitating the Baathist regime. And in fact, in many ways, in the end, the US sort of you know. Dividing Iraq along sectarian lines, and then it, you know, developing into a horrendous civil war, and then the rise of ISIS. You know, at each one of those stages, they are consequences which were, in a sense, against the premise. And I think if Chilcot serves anything, it's quite important to note what it says were wrong at different stages. So the extent to which there were other means that could have been deployed short of war, which weren't, and that was a failing. I think that's important. The second one being, of course, that it gets as close to saying that the war was illegal as, you know, he says that he's not a court and so can't make judgment on that, but it gives fuel to the idea that it was illegal, which again is a fairly specific reason for not doing it. And then you've got, you know, what it doesn't do and what it doesn't endorse is the arguments that were being made at the time, which is that any kind of intervention, you know, is in effect, you know, wrong in these circumstances. Yeah. So, you know, it's very, you know, Corbyn is in a sense on the right side of public opinion in terms of blaming Tony Blair for a catastrophic, you know, loss of life. And let's remember that, you know, loss of life in Iraq far, far, far higher than amongst British troops and ongoing still. But you know, isn't necessarily winning the argument in terms of, you know, his vision of how Britain should proceed in the world.
Sure. And we'll come back to Labour in a minute. But just to be clear on that, I mean, I'm not saying... So the Americans' argument for weapons of mass destruction was not the same as Britain. So I'm not trying to justify what Tony Blair did, but there is an interesting debate, which may be, well, not debate, but there is an interesting nuance in how each side justified the conflict, which I think that doesn't get reported over here, which is that, you know, when you say to people like John Bolton or Donald Rumsfeld in the Bush administration, oh, where were the weapons of mass destruction? They just didn't see that as important in their argument for going. But anyway...
Well, one could argue that Blair would have been more successful had he gone to the Commons and said, this is about regime change, it's about liberating the Kurdish people from oppression in northern Iraq.
The legality there would have been completely...
Sure, but I mean, you know, arguably... You know, the sort of short-term argument that was used to win over the Commons, to get around the legal ramifications, to win over the country, may not. It may have been better to have been, if you like, you know, argued for the long-term position, which was, and I think this is probably the case, that it was about you know, supporting and trying to improve upon the disastrous bit of US foreign policy and trying to get the best out of it that you could, clearly unsuccessfully.
Yeah. I mean, let's move on to the Tory leadership race, because, I mean, that is the... I mean, Chilcot's going to dominate, I'm sure, for the rest of this week, and we'll come to Labour later. But obviously there is a campaign underway for the next... who's going to be the next Prime Minister. And it does seem from YouGov polling, and we should say that, you know, I am picking up a lot of scepticism about polls, perhaps understandably, but YouGov's record on calling leadership contests is pretty good, and maybe we can come to that in a minute as to why that might be. But just to summarise some of the polling here, Theresa May dominates, I think it's fair to say. There's a series of horse race questions. She leads Andrea Leadsom by 63 points to 31, so a comprehensive victory there, and Michael Gove by 72 to 21. Michael Gove, incidentally, his positive ratings, his sort of net positive rating, if you like, has gone from plus 41 to minus 20 in the space of a week. So very clear what that's about. Their darling Boris Johnson's been torpedoed, and they don't like the sound of that and his role in it. And we'll come to some of the internals in a moment, but basically there was a list of reasons given for why might you vote the way you are, or what's important to you, sorry, in voting the way you will in the Tory leadership contest. And what I thought was interesting was that Tory members said that, you know, being a competent Prime Minister and fostering unity amongst the Conservative Party were the most important issues. Having actually campaigned for a Leave vote in the referendum was only seen as important by 30%. It was the fifth most important reason amongst members. And it was, in fact, only the third most important amongst Leave voters. So, I mean, taking all of that together, Theresa May does look in a really strong position, doesn't she? Because I suppose you could look at this sort of polling in two different ways. You could say, oh, she's the early front runner. We know that the early front runner, particularly amongst Tory MPs, often doesn't go on to win. Andy Burnham was possibly ahead at this stage, I think.
David Davis certainly was against Cameron.
Sure. I mean, I think Andy Burnham might have been ahead in a similar scenario before Corbyn joined that race, so maybe a different context. But it does seem that the frame in which Conservative Party members are looking at this through favours Theresa May.
Absolutely.
She looks very strong. And what's your assessment of her?
Yeah, I think far more important than the horse race numbers are what it is that they're valuing, and I think, you know, the irony of the contrast potentially with Labour members couldn't be more stark. They want the party to come together, and they want someone who's ready from day one to take control and to be Prime Minister. I think that to me means that you know, May is in a commanding position. I think if it's Leadsom, the entire summer will be dominated with discussions about, you know, the extent to which Leadsom's CV has been embellished or otherwise. It will be all sort of playing into the grounds of being experienced and competent and ready from day one for Theresa May. Mm. So I think there was some speculation about, you know, whether or not May would try and, or May's people would try and engineer a situation in which she faced off against Gove rather than Leadsom. I think that seems unlikely, in that I think the Tory party members would probably, you know, in a sense, smell a rat, be unhappy about having their choice engineered for them in that way. I think if it was Michael Gove, I think you'd be in for a very different kind of, you know, summer, in terms of Gove probably coming out with quite a lot of policy positions and sort of trying to attack from all angles and to get sort of lots of different points of view. I think it would be a lot more about, you know, the post-Brexit sort of negotiations and so on. I feel like actually Leadsom makes for a very ideal opponent in this sense, because, you know, known quantity versus unknown quantity. May can essentially dictate the agenda. Leadsom will be trying desperately to try and get coverage during silly season, and I think it will, you know, it'll wind to a sort of an inevitable conclusion. I don't see Leadsom suddenly striking up some big insurgency. I don't think her support in the House or amongst the membership is for that, and I think the membership want to move on and get on with, you know, in a sense, governing the country.
So, I mean, I suppose Theresa May's campaign writes itself almost, because she's winning, so she has to sort of say, I am number 10 from day one.
She's setting out a national vision.
You know, I can unite the party. But Leadsom, I mean, let's say it was Leadsom. I mean, I thought some of the cross breaks are interesting in the horse race. So we've talked about how May is on 63, Leadsom on 31. So May is winning 2-1, basically, amongst members at the moment. So then when you split that by the referendum question, and this poll suggests that the Tories voted for Leave by 2-1, which is
fits with what we might expect.
Feels reasonable. So, amongst Leave voters, Theresa May does win 49-45, but it's let's call that margin of error. It's pretty much split. But she takes 92% of the remainder. So I suppose the best way to interpret this is that, you know, it's 33% of Tory members voted Remain. They're all going to Theresa May. And then of the other 66%, half of them are going to Theresa May. So I suppose if you are Andrea Leadsom and you're trying to sort of win, let's say she goes to the final two, I suppose your only sort of option here is to convince the Leave vote in the Tory party that that is the salient issue, even if it isn't right now.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's a very dangerous path for her to go down, particularly if she wants to have a chance in a future time. Because I think nobody's, especially during the summer, I think most of the Tory party would suggest, and the polling here would suggest, that in a sense they want to sort of, as it were, gather the wagons and then go and negotiate in Brussels. I think having a proxy fight through the leadership over what nature those negotiations take would be potentially quite destabilising and problematic. And I think whilst that would be the way for Leadsom to win, I think it would ultimately be both damaging to the Tory government, but also damaging to her chances in the future, because I think it would be seen as fundamentally quite unhelpful.
So here's a question, and it's something that I have a lot of sympathy with, I think, because of the context in which this race is being run, e.g. it is about the next Prime Minister rather than a party in opposition. Why don't the Tory MPs just facilitate a coronation? Because here's my justification for that. The Conservative Party membership is going for May 2-1 anyway. They are clear at the moment that she is the head and shoulders... she's a candidate that's head and shoulders above everyone else, particularly in being a competent Prime Minister. There's agreement there amongst the membership. So although you might get commentators or certain MPs that are, frankly, pissed off about the prospect of this not going to the membership and not having that debate, it doesn't sound like there's much of a debate going on anyway. Given the country needs leadership, why don't the Tory MPs just get together? Theresa May says to Andrea Leadsom, oh, well, you can be my, I don't know, Chancellor, but something, and then just have it done by Friday.
I think the Gordon Brown not having an election or being coronated, if you like, in 2007 is the sort of salutary lesson here. I think, especially if it's seen as more or less inevitable that she will win, I think she will want that personal mandate. She will want to be able to tell critics that she has that mandate from the members, and not as much to bear down the other members and rebellious people in her own party. I think particularly given the fractious nature of the Leave referendum, it's necessary that she is able to demonstrate that she's won over, if not a majority, then certainly a substantial minority of people that took that position, and therefore has, if you like, the mandate of her support, her parliamentary supporters, and those who were opposed to, you know, the European Union on her side in those negotiations. Let's face it, she's unlikely to get the support potentially of some of the other people that voted Leave. So she might as well maximise her kind of mandate amongst those groups. Ultimately, it's silly season in terms of, I mean, I know that obviously political journalists are reading lots of, despairing tweets from political journalists about how they're, first of all, the Scottish referendum ruined one summer, then, you know, last summer was ruined by... the Labour leadership election, and then this summer's going to be ruined by the Tory leadership election. But, you know, ultimately things will wind down. There'll be relatively less scrutiny, and by, I think it's early September, they'll know the result. Meanwhile, May can be, you know, planning what she's going to do, who's going to go in what post. And I think, I don't know whether she will offer Leadsom a senior role in Cabinet or not. I guess, given her support within the parliamentary party, it would make sense to give her some senior role. But I think she would be wary of, in a sense, gifting something like the chancellorship to her on the basis of, you know, her showing there. Better to, you know, put in, as it were, an ally, a true ally, rather than a rival into that role.
You can't spend the whole summer discrediting her credentials and then give her the chancellorship as well. I suppose there is a wider philosophical debate here about the role of MPs versus members. And I was tweeting out some stuff yesterday vis-a-vis Corbyn, and let's use this as a way to go on to Labour. But, you know, ultimately, any leader, particularly a Prime Minister, is only going to get stuff done if they have the command of the support of the MPs. And therefore, there is maybe something worrying if Theresa May has the overwhelming backing of the Tories in Parliament and then the membership chooses someone else. You could end up in a tricky situation there, maybe. I mean, it's hard to say, but it has shades of Labour, doesn't it, if you end up with a leader that maybe... Tory MPs didn't want, but then it's not quite the same as Corbyn, is it?
No, and I think, well, I mean, if the Labour Party had the same system as the Conservatives, this time last year, then you can bet your bottom dollar that it would have been it wouldn't have been Corbyn going into the final two that went to the membership.
And Yvette Cooper, probably, wouldn't it?
Yes, probably. I would have thought so. So I think in a sense, the two candidates going to the membership are both, you know, in order to get through to the last two, you need to have a significant proportion of parliamentary support. I think arguably Leadsom and May's positions on most things are probably closer together than you might think.
Yeah.
You know, May was a reluctant, if you like, was a fairly reluctant Remainer and was more or less silent during the campaign. You know, she has some sort of reforming appeal in terms of being the first one who said, you know, the Tories the nasty party. She's also got some pretty, you know, good law and order kind of credentials, and, you know, on this, having been a Home Secretary, you know, on everything but immigration. So, you know, kind of, you know, I think their position, you can over dramatise the distance between their campaigns. And of course, one of the telling things has been, you know, the lack of real policy differences in terms of all of their campaigns. I think the one person to have really, through their leadership campaign for the Conservative Party, to have launched a policy agenda is actually Stephen Crabb, who's quietly bowed out, you know, with his talk about investment and reversing Osborne's kind of austerity agenda to an extent, you know. I think this is the difference, though. I think the Conservative, you know, the way in which Conservative Party chooses leaders, and this goes back to the question about a competent unifier versus a kind of someone who shares my, as it were, ideological position, is so telling. It's much more about valence issues and competence to sort of manage the country than a sort of a particularly ideological agenda. I mean, if it was about ideology, then Fox would have done much better in the ballot.
Let's finish with Labour. I mean, I was looking over this YouGov poll of Tory members, and one of the striking findings is David Cameron's ratings, actually. 69% of Tory members view David Cameron positively. To be fair, that is down 10 points from last week. I'm not sure if there's anything to make of that or not. But nevertheless, overwhelmingly, you know, positive, reminiscent of the Democrats in America, maybe, with Barack Obama. You certainly wouldn't get that with Tony Blair, would you, in the Labour Party? And I suppose what I really want to talk about is this potential Labour coup, because
Angela, it's not a coup, Kieran, it's a siege.
Siege. I mean, we'll come on to that. But Angela Eagle was one of the people that was named as somebody that might stand, and she's indicated that she might. But after Chilcot, I mean, we've talked about this before, but someone that voted for the Iraq War is just not going to beat Jeremy Corbyn, are they?
I think it's certainly harder for them to do that. I think a lot of this boils down to whether or not it's a direct challenge to Corbyn, in which case I think you're right. I think it is hard. It will be harder for Eagle, but it was always going to be harder for Eagle in that sense. But that's a different question to if he stands down and, for the sake of argument, you know, a deal is done to make sure that Clive Lewis or someone of that ilk is able to make it to the ballot paper, as the sort of the assurances are given that if he sort of, as it were, goes quietly, maybe now, maybe after the summer recess, after Labour Party conference, whatever it would be, that in time for what looks more likely to be a spring election than an autumn election.
Do you think there will be an election?
I mean, I don't know.
We don't know, but I mean, you know, we don't know who the Prime Minister is going to be, but I mean, is that likely? I mean, Theresa May seemed to put the kibosh on that.
I think so. I mean, I think it depends at what pace the Brexit negotiations proceed, and it also depends on where the Labour Party gets to in terms of its, you know, setup. I think if, in a sense, the Labour Party can't carry on like it is at the moment, it's just untenable to have a front bench that doesn't have enough people on it to serve, and so something's got to give. I've no idea how that will pan out or when it will pan out, but I think all of those things go into the calculation. Ultimately, I think if Theresa May feels like she's in a strong position, or whatever point in the road this comes, with the support of her parliamentary colleagues in the Tory party, and feels like the country at large would be largely supportive of their Labour is in disarray, The moment then is to go and get a mandate from the country to negotiate whatever it is that she thinks she can achieve in the Brexit negotiations. That, to me, makes a lot of sense.
Mm. Well, lots of logistical issues there as well, I suppose. But I think we'll leave it there for today. Certainly lots to keep an eye on. I mean, who knows? By next week, we might end up with a new Prime Minister already, and we'll certainly have lots to discuss. But Rob, thanks for joining me. That's all we've got time for this week's Political Betting and Polling Matters podcast. Do like, share on Twitter, retweet, subscribe to iTunes, all that sort of stuff helps us get the voice out there. We should be back in the flesh next week if you can bear us on Tip TV. But until then, thanks for listening.